Okay, so first I just want to thank Lars and Bob for inviting me here to give this talk today. And I also especially want to thank them for giving me this very provocative and very long title, Observations of Supernovae 1A that provide evidence for circumstellar interaction. So I've been thinking about this title over the past couple of weeks. I think that really what we need here in order to address this sort of problem is a two-pronged approach, very much along the lines as Alex was discussing in his talk the other day. Generally speaking, circumstellar interaction in 4-1A supernovae appears to be an all-or-nothing kind of deal. So I'm going to spend half the time talking about the all scenario, and this focuses on hybrid supernovae. You might call these 2002 IC-like. You may call them type 2As. Regardless, I'm not going to talk about the optical spectroscopy. I think Alex covered that well. I'm going to focus more on the radio observations and the host galaxy properties, which I think give us unique and important diagnostics that haven't been discussed yet. The second part of my talk is going to be the nothing scenario, and this is going to be focused on circumstellar interaction in normal supernovae 1A. And when I say normal, I just mean that there isn't a large booming H-alpha emission line. Again, I'm not going to talk about the optical spectroscopy. I think Alex gave a very good overview of the limits on H-alpha emission. I'm going to talk about the radio observations and also X-ray observations of normal 1As. And I'll just say a couple of things at the end in terms of looking forward, how should we make progress in this question. Too bad this doesn't work. So, so before I jump in, I want to be very... I want to be very clear about which supernovae I'll be discussing when I talk about hybrid supernovae. And I'll be including in the group today 97CY, 99E, 2002 IC, and 2005 GJ. Now, these are all hybrid supernovae within a few hundred megaparsecs. Other possible members of this group include supernova 7017, recovered from the Sloan sample, and perhaps 2006 GY. The latter example is actually quite controversial. So here is a histogram of the peak optical magnitudes for hybrid supernovae in red, compared with the peak optical magnitudes of type 2Ns in yellow, and here is a canonical type 1A. So the bottom line is, of course, that these events are very luminous, which we've heard about before. So again, I'm not going to say much about spectroscopy. I just really want to reiterate that what's very important is the inferred mass loss rates for these events are very high. They're higher than those that we infer for type 2N supernovae. That's important for the radio and X-ray observations. So since I am a young person here and I am giving a talk in the young people session, I thought I would just sort of give my perspective on these events. So it's been 10 years since 97CY was discovered, and the temporal proximity to the discovery of 98BW with the associated GRB actually very much affected the interpretation of this event. The current interpretation is that this one is a, the initial interpretation is that 97CY was a broadline type 2N associated with a gamma ray burst. I'll also point out that it was a short, hard gamma ray burst that it was supposedly associated with. Now, a couple of years later, 99E looked similar to 97CY, and they adopted the same interpretation. Must be a GRB supernova with broad lines that has hydrogen. And in fact, along the way, they actually became members of the hypernova group, and Ken Nemoto actually and his collaborators worked very much on modeling these events. In 2003, though, Mario came forward and looked at observations of 2002 IC and compared it with these two events and said maybe it's actually a hydrogen-rich 1A. At this point, they got thrown out of the hypernova class, and we moved sort of in this direction. Observations and publications on 2005 GJ support the hydrogen-rich interpretation, but very recently, as Alex mentioned, there is a new model which suggests that perhaps these events are just hydrogen-rich type 1bc supernovae. This isn't actually a very, it's not a crazy thing to say. In fact, here's an example of a type 1c supernova with booming H-alpha emission at late time that I worked on as part of my thesis. But just to sort of conclude, you know, we've really come full circle. It's been 10 years, and we're back at the idea that these guys are associated with GRBs. So I think it's clear that we need other diagnostics. We're not really making progress here. And other diagnostics do come from other wavelengths. Radio and X-rays are especially important because here we're probing different ejecta. We've heard a lot about the photospheric observations of these events, and basically here we're looking at the bulk ejecta. It has low velocities, and it has the bulk of the kinetic energy is coupled to these ejecta. If we now look at the fastest ejecta, this is dynamically interacting with the circumstellar material. And here, the velocities are higher, and the energy coupled to these ejecta is actually quite low. It's less than 1% of the total kinetic energy. And this is a plot I stole from my GRB, one of my GRB papers, but I think it nicely illustrates that you can get sort of a, two different handles on the explosion. This is kinetic energy versus ejecta velocity. And by modeling the optical emission, which is thermal, Paolo and Ken and others have shown that you can actually extract how much kinetic energy is coupled to slow-moving material. At the same time, by modeling the radio and X-ray emission, which is here non-thermal emission, synchrotron emission, you can actually understand how much kinetic energy is coupled to very fast ejecta. And I do want to emphasize there's two ways to actually get strong radio and X-ray emission from supernovae. It can be either due to a central engine, which enables you to have a lot of energy coupled to fast ejecta, such as in the case of a GRB, or you could just have a very dense circumstellar medium, which is the case for type 2N supernovae. I think this duality is best, or is actually reflected in this plot here. This is what I would call a variation of the Roger Chevalier plot, and he would have shown it if he had been here. This is peak radio luminosity versus the time of the radio peak. And here I show radio observations for GRBs and 1BC supernovae here from my that I've worked on as part of my thesis. These are observations of type 2N that have been collected from the literature. It's a bit of a busy plot. But the bottom line is that the time of the radio peak is very much a function of how fast is the fastest ejecta and what is the mass loss rate of the progenitor star. If you end up on this part of the diagram, you're more likely to be a GRB. If you end up over here, you're more likely to be a type 2N. Now, the hybrid supernovae have all been observed in the radio, and their upper limits, I should say none of them are detected, unfortunately, but the upper limits are all shown here. I think it's interesting to note that the time scale of the observations are actually quite poor, that they end up in the between these two classes. And they're also pretty shallow. They're not very deep observations, and they're sparse. There's just one epoch for most of them. So I do want to emphasize that, you know, if we do have mass loss rates higher than those of an ordinary type 2N supernova, then we would actually expect them to peak very late. And so in case there's anyone from the NRAO TAC here, I recently put in a proposal to actually go back and look at these events at late time and see if we see strong radio emission, you know, on these sort of timescales. Another component will also be looking at the very the newly discovered hybrid supernovae at very early time to see if we see evidence for a central engine. I also want to talk about host galaxies, as I was saying. And here is just a collection of the post-galaxy imaging for these four well-studied events. And the observers in the room will quickly notice that these are spectroscopic finding charts. And that's not a coincidence, because I think that the bottom line is we really need spectroscopy of these events. All four of these host galaxies are anonymous in the sense they would not fall into a targeted search campaign such as CAPE. And here are just some snapshots of my 2D spectra. The bottom line is they all show strong H-alpha emission, which means they're strongly star-forming. And based on the line emission profiles, based on the various emission lines, I have calculated the star formation rate and the metallicities for these hosts, and I give the values here. The values for 2005 GJ are taken from the Aldrin paper. So I think the first interesting comparison would be to make with the host galaxies of type 1A supernovae. So this is the sample presented in the Gallagher et al. Paper, 2005. Here is a distribution of the metallicity for nearby 1A host galaxies, and here is the H-alpha luminosity as a function of delta M15. We don't really care about the delta M15 here, but I just thought these are two important parameters, and here are where the hybrid supernovae lie with respect to ordinary 1A hosts. You can see that they're lower in terms of both metallicity and H-alpha luminosity, which is, of course, a proxy for star formation rate, than are the typical 1As. And I think it'd be interesting to hear, perhaps from Sarab later on, if 2002 CX-like events also share this property in terms of their host galaxies. Another very interesting comparison is to the host galaxies of 1BC supernovae, because, again, it has been suggested that these are simply hydrogen-rich 1BCs. And here is a plot from a recent paper by Myron Lojas showing the metallicity as a function of host galaxy luminosity. The 1BC supernovae are shown in blue. GRBs are shown in red. And here, this big yellow span of points just goes to, it's just there to sort of convince you that, yes, there is a metallicity-luminosity relation. The hybrid supernovae, which I have presented here, will end up here in the sort of area of the plot. So you can see that they're lower in both metallicity and luminosity than are the 1BCs. If you actually look at the star formation rates that I gave in the table, and you compare them with those in this paper by Amarium, they're actually comparable to those of 1BCs, but they're significantly lower than those of GRBs, for which we see very strong star formation in about a solar mass per year. So what can we understand? You know, are these explosions GRBs and not, based on this comparison? I think that we really have to be careful in making any sort of strong statements based on these data alone. The problem is that most of these blue points here for the 1BCs are taken from targeted samples, which actually bias against ever finding a supernova in a low metallicity, low luminosity host, such as the ones that the type 2As are found in. And I think this is probably better shown here. This is a plot from one of my recent proposals. So here is a distribution, a cumulative distribution, of the luminosities of 1BC host galaxies from targeted surveys, such as KATE, and within the same volume, the luminosity of the host from blind surveys, such as Sloan and the Supernova Factory. And you can see that we're really probing two different populations here. If you want to find low metallicity hosts and study them, you really have to move to these blind studies. And that's really the comparison that needs to be made here. So that brings me to the second part of my talk. Perfect. And this is the nothing part of the talk. I think that the most suggestive observation for circumstellar interaction in a normal type 1A supernova actually comes from a recent paper by Stefan Immler. He looked at a sample of 8 type 1A supernovae with the Swift satellite, and he found that only one of them, 2005 KE, showed evidence for a 3-sigma bump in the X-ray observation. I don't know if you can see this, but here is the XRT image. And you can see in this circle, this is the 3-sigma bump that he attributes to the supernova. You have to be very careful because the PSF of XRT is quite large, 6 arc seconds. But he says also, you know, look, we also see evidence for a UV excess in this object that we don't see in the other 1A supernovae, and that's shown here. So the authors attribute this to circumstellar interaction, and they derive a mass loss rate of 3 × 10⁻⁶ solar masses per year. But I do think that this result has to be taken sort of with a grain of salt, or at least examined carefully. Chandra was triggered to confirm the presence of X-ray emission from the supernova, and there was no detection, which is shown here. And I think that could be just attributed to the fact that this has a better resolution than XRT. And what we could have been seeing was simply galaxy substructure in the XRT image. Despite working very hard, I never detected radio emission from this event, which I would have expected to with such a mass loss rate. And despite looking also very hard in the optical, no H-alpha emission was ever discovered. And this is the CSP has worked very hard on this event as well, as Mark was telling us. There's no H-alpha here, especially on these timescales. He's also shown me over the past couple of days that there's other subluminous type 1A supernovae that show a similar UV excess. So it could just be that we don't really understand yet the UV spectra of type 1A supernovae. Which brings me to the last part of the talk, very much promised after after my comments on Wednesday. So here is a sort of a summary of radio observations of normal type 1A supernovae. And again, this is important for constraining single degenerate systems where you have these wide binaries with massive companions. Here is a radio map, which is infrequently shown at these sort of conferences. This is for 2006X at a distance of just about 50 megaparsecs. And this actually happened about a year ago today. I took these observations here at KATP under a TOO program. At any rate, this is also, I should mention, the event which does show evidence for variable variations in the sodium ions. And there is simply no detection here. You can see I have a very tight limit, 15 microjanskis is the RMS. And it's not the only limit. Well, it's one of the deepest limits we have to date, but not the only one. Of course, Pangea has published another about 25 or so, as shown here, at 4 different radio frequencies. Now, these lines here that they include in their plot are the predicted radio luminosities for a type 1A supernova for various assumptions about the mass loss rate of the companion star. And just to be very clear about what they are assuming, they assume that the 1A radio light curve will be the same as that of a 1BC radio light curve. Specifically, they pick supernova 1983N, and if you're curious, supernova 1983N looks like this at 1.5 gigahertz. They also assume that the low frequency emission will be dominated by free absorption. They assume there will be a wind density profile and that the companion wind will have a velocity of 10 kilometers per second. And by comparing their models here with the observations, and particularly this very stringent limit down here, they come up with an upper limit on the mass loss rate of 3 × 10⁻⁸ solar masses per year. So now to sort of say what I think would be the correct way to do this. The first assumption, assuming that the radial light curves of 1As will look the same as 1BCs, is actually a pretty good assumption. Now, Roger Chevalier has been saying this for years, so has Klaus Brunson. And the reason is simply because you have this sort of stripped envelope or naked explosion that's happening in a low-density environment. That's the reason for this assumption. The next assumption that they made, however, was incorrect. In fact, what we expect is that 1A radial light curves should be dominated by synchrotron self-absorption. In fact, this is what's predicted for type 1BC supernovae observed in the radial, as shown by Roger in several papers, and it's actually very much observationally confirmed. This is some of the work I've done for my thesis. In a synchrotron self-absorbed scenario, you expect at low frequencies a new to the 5/2 spectrum. And here is a nice example. This is type 1C supernova 2003 BG. These are two snapshot radio spectra going from 300 megahertz out to 50 gigahertz or so. And you can see that the optically thick part of the spectrum is perfectly consistent with new to the 5/2. Free-free absorption would steepen the spectrum, shown by the dashed line, and it's simply inconsistent with what we see. So we're pretty confident that we know that these explosions are dominated by synchrotron self-absorption. And as shown by various people, including Tony Reedhead, if we assume equipartition of energy between relativistic electrons and magnetic fields, we actually get some pretty robust constraints on the radius and energy of the total, of the radio-emitting material. And this scale is simply optical parameters, namely the luminosity and frequency of the radio peak. If you additionally assume information about the explosion time and how much energy is actually coupled to magnetic fields, you also get a constraint on the mass loss rate. So just to sort of emphasize, this is actually a very powerful method. Here is a nice example, supernova 2003L, for which we have very good radio data. By modeling these radio data, you actually get very important information about the post-shock energy density, the circumstellar density, the magnetic fields. And when you actually couple it with X-ray observations, you can break the degeneracy between epsilon E and epsilon B. That is to say, you no longer have to assume we're in equipartition. So it's a very powerful method. But it really requires that you observe the radial peak. You really need to see this peak. If you don't, then it's very difficult to do this sort of analysis. And this is very much important when it comes to the limits on the 1A. So here is what I would present if I was going to present the radio limits from the Panagia paper. This is the velocity of the fastest material in the explosion, and this is the mass loss rate shown down here. And if, in this parameter space, 1BC supernovae would lie somewhere here. These are all from my thesis. GRBs, I've just thrown them in just so you can see where they would be as well. Here is a lower limit, as predicted by Nemoto in 84, on the accretion rate required for a 1A explosion, 4 × 10⁻⁸. And these lines here are the lines that are derived from the 1A limit. So let me explain them. Each gray line here is actually elbow-shaped, and it rules out the parameter space above it. And if you wonder why it has an elbow shape, it's simply because we don't know whether the limit is constraining the decay or the rise or the peak of the light curve. So you really have to be careful and do it properly. So you notice that all of these elbow-shaped curves really rule out most of this parameter space that I have here. But I want to be very clear about what I've assumed in order to do this. I've assumed, again, a 1BC light curve is appropriate. I've assumed a wind velocity and a wind density profile. I've assumed we're at equipartition, and I assume an epsilon B of 0.1. Now, this seems to be pretty reasonable for type 1BC supernovae, but there's no reason to assume that it will necessarily be the same for type 1As. I've also assumed that the fastest velocity in the shock velocity is about 0.03 to 0.1C. That means it's faster than the photosphere, but not too fast, which puts us in this band here. So you can see that we're really pushed into this uncomfortable corner over here where, just by eyeball, I would say that the limit, upper limit on the mass loss rate is a few times 10⁻⁸. But if you just change epsilon B by a factor of 10, which is a completely reasonable thing to do, if you take an epsilon B that's actually 0.01, which is what we find for gamma ray bursts, we really open up this parameter space that's allowed. And if you want to take in another factor of 10, which is also fine, this is what we find for short hard gamma ray bursts, we're really opening up this space again. So the limit really requires a lot of assumptions. And so I think that we need to be very cautious in understanding what is really understood from these radio data. That being said, radio is very important, and if we actually detect one and see the spectral peak, it will be a huge contribution to understanding the progenitors of type 1a supernovae. So looking forward, I think that the EVLA is going to make a really significant contribution in this field. We're going to get a factor of 10 in sensitivity with a new correlator once it gets installed in about a year or so. And you can actually use my 1BC radio sample to try to make predictions about what we're going to see for 1As in the EVLA era. Here is radioluminosity versus distance for all of the 1BCs I've looked at as part of my thesis. And all of these lines here are basically the radio light curves compressed on the time axis. So I want to especially emphasize, and I should also point out, this is the standard 3 sigma upper limit that we see, and these gray triangles are all of the non-detections of the 1BCs. There are quite a few of them. I want to point out this event way down here. This is supernova 2002 AP, a very subluminous radio supernova, which was only detected because it's at 7 megaparsecs. But with the EVLA, with the capability of the EVLA, we'll be able to detect something like 2002 AP, which could be exactly what a type 1A radio supernova looks like out to the Virgo cluster. So we're really increasing that volume to which we're sensitive. So just to conclude, looking forward, I think that hybrid supernovae really require blind surveys. And so it's going to be very important to focus on Sloan and Pan-STARRS and LSST in the distant future. It seems like these hosts may be different from those of the bulk population of 1A hosts, but obviously more work needs to be done. Radio observations can really probe the engine-driven material, and this is very important. And I will hopefully be doing this in the next few months with the VLA. X-ray and radio observations of normal 1A are also very important programs to search for circumstellar interactions. And I do think that I want to emphasize that the fast slewing capability of SWIFT really makes this possible, along with the queue scheduling at the VLA. So I think these are also complementary to efforts such as Doug Leonard's looking for the H-alpha emission in early and late time spectra. And again, I think we just really need to take caution in understanding what do the data tell us and how do we interpret these upper limits. And I'll stop there.
Questions? Stefan. Roseanne.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about the assumptions on MDOT itself. Yeah. Are you assuming, and not just you, but it looks like you know, the standard in the field, are you assuming that it is more or less constant in time?
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, that actually, it's hard to know because there are so many different ways binaries can do it, but at least in these close binary supersoft sources, it's possible that there's a very long epoch, perhaps 10 to the 6 years or so, where there's no winds,
right,
which, you know, coming after an epoch where there were very high winds. So would you care to speculate on how, if we used a model like that, and maybe in addition also change the wind speeds to make them somewhat higher,
sure,
would that, you know, put you in the direction of opening up the space as some of the gamma ray burst comparisons did, or would it make it more restrictive?
Actually, no, it's a very good point. So we do actually have the capability of understanding the effect on the of the circumstellar density profile on the radio emission. I mean, for instance, about half of the radio supernovae I look at have these gigantic variations that are attributed to circumstellar variations. And so we do have the tools to model those and extract the, you know, relevant densities. Your question about the wind is very important because I do want to emphasize that we're always only constraining m dot over v. So, you know, you make that assumption when I assume 10 kilometers per second, if I want to assume a larger velocity, my m dot limit goes up.
And it could be significantly larger,
yeah,
one or two orders of magnitude.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a suggestion on language, which is that we probably shouldn't call a search that's impartial a blind search.
Sure.
I just think that blind is kind of the wrong word. And then, of course, it can't be entirely, it's certainly right that that's the way to go, an impartial search. But it can't quite be true that it's impossible to discover them without an impartial search, because we've discovered some of them. And you might, you know, even with Kate, for example, where they target the search, there are other galaxies in the field, and
sure,
sometimes the supernovae are found in those other galaxies. So the actual search of which galaxies have been searched is not the target list. It's the ones in which they've been found, which is a broader list of galaxies.
That's very true. I'm just pointing out the bottom line is all four of them come from these untargeted surveys, if that's what you would like to call them. I'm happy with that. I call them
impartial.
Impartial, that's even better. But I just, make life easier. That's really the way to do
it.
You can certainly try to search the background galaxies in way
but
to it, search.
Okay.
We'll have a vote on it later. Philip.
One other thing you may want to look at, instead of just having a steady stellar wind, is having a shell-like structure,
sure,
as you might get from recurrent novae, as General showed in her talk. If you look at Azufyuki, you probably would expect a shell-like structure.
Sure.
And getting that signature in the radio would, of course, be perfect.
I think, so the cavities, the size of the cavities are very much a function of, it is important to realize that the shock velocity here is, much ahead of the photosphere. So we are actually probing these, I would think, where the cavity ends much sooner than, let's say optical observations do.
Yeah, almost exactly the same question that the difference of the 97 CY auto IC class from other type 2N is the light curve drops. That requires only one solar mass of the circumstellar matter, like a shell structure.
Right.
And so it's very different from Wolfay and so on. So the radio curve also gives the similar constraint parameter for the circumstellar matter, one solar mass or kind of things.
The radio, so of course, you have to do the most basic thing first, which is assume a constant velocity wind or a constant constant velocity wind. But I would like to point out that, Ryan Foley has this very nice new paper on 2006 JC, which is, of course, a 1BC supernova, but he does infer a cavity and then sort of a shell of material at a larger radius. And then, in fact, the radio observations are fully consistent with that. We see it turn on very late. So that's why I really think that it's important to probe the radio on both timescales of early and late. We should pick it up.
Alicia, I just want to let you know, I think the numbers you're getting there, you're starting with, are extremely interesting just for direct comparison to RSO. What we think the mass loss rate from the giant is in that system is, we only have actually upper limit, but it's around somewhere below 6 × 10⁻⁸ solar masses per year.
Okay.
And that one, we think, has a wind velocity of 20 kilometers per second. So you're just in the right regime.
Yep.
You can get a little bit more. That's very, very interesting.
Exactly. For my students will do it.
So, Alicia, you mentioned in your talk that you have only one epoch of radio observation for many of this 1BC.
Yeah.
And many predictions actually is, the radio should be turned on, maybe a decade later.
Right.
So is there any way that, you also said you have a proposal to do this kind of a long-term study. Do you expect, there will be like a big change in the detection rate for this 1BC in the second epoch?
For the 1BCs or for the hybrid supernovae?
For the 1BCs.
For the 1BCs. So right now I do probe 1BCs on all timescales. My proposal is to look at the hybrid supernovae, 2002 IC, at a late timescale. So I looked at about 70 1BCs at late time, any timescales from a year up to several decades, and only one out of 70 was detected. That was supernova 2001 EM. So we already have an idea for how frequently this occurs. It's not very frequent.
I'll have a question of my own. What is going on with the 1BCs? Why are they so infrequently detected? Should they always be there?
Very interesting question. I don't think we have the answer yet. I mean, we're seeing a huge variation in the luminosities and a huge variation in the time of the peaks, the mass loss rates. I think it's really interesting, and a really nice comparison would be to try to understand also how does this correlate with optical data, because I know as part of Tom's thesis, he actually saw that there was a lot more heterogeneity in the 1Cs than in the 1Bs, which is exactly what I'm seeing in the radio. So I think that kind of
separate those out.
Well,
the class is pretty small.
With Mariam, she feels that there are one class, and I know this has been put forth by several of the people. 1BC. a dear student.
No, that there are three kinds of 1Cs.
First a comment, but not for the speaker. Clearly blind search, clearly silly. Egalitarian, would that be better? O2IC, O2CX, and O5GJ were all found in egalitarian searches. The question, though, for radio, are there, I know you're just considering the simplest models, and that, of course, makes complete sense, but are there specific features you would see if there is structure in the circumstellar material?
Yes. So generally, it takes not very much. I have an example. You know what? I actually have it. So here is actually the results from my survey, if we want to talk about 1BCs. And here is an example shown in green. This is supernova 2003BG. You can see it has two bumps. And the second bump here is produced by a variation in the density by just a factor of two. Just a factor of two, and this is what happens. So we do have a good handle on understanding what will happen. I should have also said that if we are plowing into a constant density medium, the light curves actually don't decrease. They actually increase for the 1A. So it is important that we'll get even more stringent limits on those cases.
Okay, thank you again, Alicia. And don't get up yet, because Lars wants to tell us something.